Yeah, hilarious. I work with some really creative, talented people. Shout out to Jacob and Jim Cousy for their creative talents on that little project. Good stuff. Glad to have Jacob back from gallivanting over in Europe. Good that he was here today. Pastor Doug is out of town. He will return to the office tomorrow. So I want to make you aware of that. Well, let's get started. The beauty of pastor's choice, as Pastor Doug alluded to last week, is the freedom to do anything you want to do, and basically it's okay. So, we were asked to submit our topics for pastor's choice to Pastor Doug a few months ago, and I submitted what I thought I was going to teach, and I thought I was going to do a message on this book that I wrote over the vacation, as Jacob said, that I took last summer. And the message was titled, Stay in School. I was going to detail the incredible story of our Hillcrest partnership with Cleveland and how we became a church that the community would miss through our service with that school. Started to write that on earlier this week and decided not to actually finish writing that message. You're like, oh man, so you know, I'm going to close my eyes, you can get up and leave, or you know, check your chili or do what you want to do. I do have an email list that serves as kind of an update on the book. Emails come out about every week. If you're not on there, I know a lot of you are, but if you're not on there, come up afterwards, put your name on there. We'll make sure you get updates on the book. This Friday, you'll have the opportunity to maybe help me out with a title, because apparently books need titles. So need some help there. But rather than a message on the book, I instead want to take you through some stuff that God has been doing in my life as a result of working on the book. And so I want to share with you some things I've kind of learned through this process of having an idea to write a book and then giving something that maybe you will actually read at some point. Last year at this time, so in January of 2017, word was out that I was going to be going on this sabbatical. And the sabbatical was going to be May, June, and July. And of course, when people find out that you're taking 3 months away from work, the natural question is, well, what are you going to do? And by now, you know that I am not a home repair or auto mechanic type of guy, so the best that the Torino was going to get out of that deal was a cleaner garage. So,
awesome.
Yeah, that was awesome, but it took a day. So, and the kids were still in school, so that limited some things. Sabbatical wasn't going to help my notoriously bad golf game. 3 months wasn't going to salvage that. And so at some point, my answer to that question was, well, I'm going to write a book. And that question invited other questions like, well, what's your book about? And do you have a publisher? Brian, do you even know how to write a book? And then how is the book coming? Well, the first three questions were easy. No, did not have a publisher, do not have a publisher. Second, I do not know how to write a book, even though I've got a draft to an editor. I still don't know, still not confident that I know how to do that. But what the book was about was going to be easy as well, right? Tell the story of our church with Cleveland and use that to kind of maybe springboard other churches to partner with public schools. So I went on sabbatical and I began to write the book. And it wasn't this, magical book writing experience, whatever you picture that to be. I didn't squirrel away at some cabin on some lake or, go to the mountains or go to Newton Hills and, light a candle and, make some coffee and go, let's just, Father, what do you want to write today? That kind of thing. I was at my kitchen table, pretty sexy spot, just sat at my kitchen table, had my laptop. Did you outline it, Brian? Nope, no outline. Well, certainly use some sort of system, right? No index cards, no master whiteboard where, I could outline stuff. No chapters, just one big, long Microsoft Word document. Seriously. And some days were awesome. Some days the writing just kind of flowed and came easy. Other days were hard. Took all day maybe to crack out a page or two. But towards the end of my sabbatical in July, I had written down basically everything I could think of in connection to the story. And I had done what I was going to do, and I was nowhere close to being done. I came across this tweet by the author Beth Moore, We didn't check this today. Hey, it's working. All right. And Beth Moore tweeted this in June. She said, there's this thing about being an author. It's how your book is so much better. I do mean utterly fabulous before you actually write it. There's so much truth in what she is saying. Because when I got to the end of that process, I looked at what I had typed out. I'm like, who would ever, and I mean ever, want to read this? I don't even want to go back and read it. I want to be done. Just hit save, put it in a folder somewhere, and call it good. And so I came back to work here and kind of forgot about the book, but I kept being asked that fourth question, which was, so how's the book coming? And some of you asked me, and some of my family asked me, and the guys that I meet with on Friday mornings would periodically ask me, and you know, I couldn't shake that question, because for a while I could say, well, I'm halfway through, or I'm three-fourths of the way through, or I've got so many words written, or so many pages written, but I got to the end of the process, and all I had was this, you know, jumbled Microsoft Word document that was a big mess. And so this fall, the Friday morning guys I meet with, we went through this book called Finish by John Acuff. It's a quick read. It's one of the better books I've read about finishing goals and completing projects. And side note, it's January, so if you've started a resolution of some sort, a health resolution or financial or relational, great book to pick up to help you accomplish that resolution. But we went through that book with the guys on Friday mornings, and that really gave me the inspiration to kind of go to the next step, which was I needed to do some reviewing or some editing to this thing. I needed to put some chapters to it and kind of create some outline or some separation. So my daughter had volleyball practice Monday nights. I would take her to that, and then I would sit in the lobby and kind of hammer out that part of the book. There was this other dad there who was a Bears fan, and he and I would kind of commiserate about how bad our teams were doing, and then he would leave, and then I would do that work, and so split it up into chapters and headlines and subtitles and that type of thing. I moved around stuff, I added stuff, I deleted stuff, and I thought, you know, I got to the end of that in October. I felt pretty good about it, but I knew based on books that I had read and other books that three steps were now needed. The first was I needed a professional to edit my draft, right? I need to have someone who's better at the English language than I am take a look at it. Second thing I needed to do was to share the draft with people whose story I was telling. So I'm telling Hillcrest stories, so I thought, you know, might want to give the elders a heads up, right? Might want to have leadership council, you know, take a peek at it. Might want to have Jackie McNamara, the principal at Cleveland, when we began our work, take a look at it as well and kind of just say, hey, common courtesy, you know, heads up, this is what's going on. And then I knew I'd need to begin to get the word out that I had written a book, you know, create that email list or whatever to build interest in the project. I knew what those steps were. I knew I had to, you know, what I need to do. And in fact, in my planner, I use this planner every week, and it says, you can see personal to-do list, and it says, build email list and finish editing book. And the way my planner works is obviously if you do that, you can cross it off, right? If you don't do that, you can either leave it there, or when you turn to the next week, you can put that same action item on that same to-do list. I wrote those same two things for 11 straight weeks. 11 straight weeks, I knew what I needed to do, and I didn't do it. And the reason it took so long was I was afraid. I was fearful. I was scared. Because I knew that once I sent it to an editor, and once I told Jackie and the leadership and my family about the book, and once I told, you know, invited people to get updates on the book, that's kind of the point of no return. Right? You're kind of committed at that point to seeing this thing through. And once I did those things, I was opening up the opportunity for people to provide feedback, right, on a certain project. And, you know, opportunities for people to say, you know what, I like this, or I didn't like this, or I you know, disagree with this, or I agree with this. And so I waited for so long to follow through on what are really simple steps because of fear. And I found it easier to hold on to what I had written. I found it easier to say, you know what, I wrote what I wanted to write, and I kept it up here, and I kept it in here, but I didn't actually do anything with it. I knew once I invited other people into the process, that was going to be it. And perhaps you're like me, and you live life like this. Maybe you find it easier, more comfortable to hold on to what we know rather than lean into what God is calling you to or calling you to pursue. You got the soul provider today, the program there, your first fill-in is we stay comfortable because we're afraid. We stay comfortable because we're afraid. And I'm reminded of our ancestors in the faith, the Israelites, who knew a little something about choosing comfort over pursuing what God wanted them to pursue. And if you remember Joseph in the Old Testament book of Genesis, Genesis, first book in the Bible, first book in the Old Testament, last 12, 13 chapters of the book are about Joseph. Joseph is the amazing technicolor dream coat guy, right? He's the one that gets the dreams, and his brothers hate him, and they want to kill him, but they sell him into slavery, and the Midianites take him to Egypt, and he rises towards the end of the book of Genesis. He is the number two guy in the Egyptian empire. It's Pharaoh, and then it's Joseph. And Joseph, through this miraculous reconciliation with his family, saves the Israelite people from this devastating famine happening in the Middle East. And all of the Israelites kind of migrate to where Joseph is, so that when you open up the book of Exodus, the Israelites are kind of living in modern-day Egypt. And so Exodus chapter 1, verses 7 through 10 says this. But their descendants, the Israelites, had many children and grandchildren. In fact, they multiplied so greatly that they became extremely powerful and filled the land. Eventually, a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he had done. He said to his people, "Look, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than we are. We must make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us. Then they will escape from the country." So this is when the Israelites begin as slaves for the Egyptians. So the Israelites are conscripted into slavery. They're making bricks and basically bricks, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Exodus continues with the miraculous birth of Moses. Remember Moses, right? He is kind of spared from the genocide that was happening at that time. He is spared from that. He grows up in Pharaoh's home. He kills an Egyptian. He flees because he's afraid. He talks to a burning bush, and then he comes back to confront Pharaoh and negotiate for Israel's release through a series of escalating plagues. An important detail here is how long is it between the death of Joseph and when Moses is on the scene? And scholars put that anywhere from 100 to 300 or 400 years. It's enough time where the Pharaoh and the current Egyptian leadership have no knowledge of who Joseph is. That's 100 years at least, four generations at least, at a minimum of slavery. Day after day, week after week, year after year, making bricks. And then the Israelite people begin to experience the movement of God on their behalf, right? They see the plagues. They see the Nile turn red. They see the sky get dark. They see that last plague where their firstborns are spared because they put blood on the doorposts where the Egyptian firstborns are not. They see this miraculous rescue and deliverance from Egyptian control, and they make their way to the Red Sea. They get to the Red Sea and they see that they think this is the end, only for Moses to, you know, part the Red Sea, and they walk across dry land and they see the Egyptian army chasing after them in the distance. And when the Egyptians get to the Red Sea, the sea collapses on them and then they die. And you would think, if you were an Israelite after seeing and experiencing all of that, right, that you would just be so confident in who this God was. He had taken you from slavery. You had seen the plagues. You had walked across dry land on the Red Sea. And you would think, there is nothing we cannot do. Exodus 16, 1 through 3. The whole community of Israel set out from Elim and journeyed into the wilderness of Sin between Elim and Mount Sinai. They arrived there on the 15th day of the second month, 1 month after leaving the land of Egypt. There, too, the whole community of Israel complained about Moses and Aaron. "If only the Lord had killed us back in Egypt," they moaned. "There we sat around pots filled with meat and ate all the bread that we wanted. But now you have brought us in this wilderness to starve us all to death." Jump back to verse 2. Okay, the word that we have highlighted there, 1 month. Understand that it had been 1 month, 31 days from when they had left Egypt to this point in the text right here. 1 month. They wanted to go back to slavery after 30 days. That seemed like a better option to them than what they were experiencing right now. That is how incredibly addicting that comfort and what you know can be, is it not? When they look back longingly at Egypt and go, "Man, do you remember when we just used to make brick after brick? Oh, those were the good old days. Man." And when they doubled our output and we had to work twice as hard with the same amount of time and resources, that was so awesome. Oh my goodness, I just want to go back there. 30 days! They saw the plagues, they walked across the Red Sea 30 days later. They're already doubting God. It's almost incomprehensible. A couple things here to point out. Couple of fill-ins. We complain because we're afraid. The Israelites are grumbling and they're whining and they're complaining and they're griping. And I believe the source of that was because they're afraid of what is next, or they're afraid of the unknown, or they're afraid of growing past what was comfortable to them. In doing some reading for this, I came across this interesting challenge. It's called the 21-day no complaint experiment. And what it is you know, if you've got one of those bracelets, cause bracelets or whatever, you can just get a rubber band and you put it on one wrist and try to make it a whole day without complaining. The minute you complain, you take the rubber band off, you put it on the other wrist, the whole challenge starts over. So if you get to like day 5, day 6, and you gripe about something, your team loses, you know, something doesn't go right, boom, off the wrist and a new 21 days starts. And maybe the only thing we get out of this morning is trying that, huh? How long could you go, how long could I go without complaining about something? And secondly, we stay because we're afraid. Now, we prefer the known to the unknown. It is so hard to move past what we know. It's almost incomprehensible that they were already complaining, but the reason it's almost incomprehensible is because we know what it's like to be in that position, to have something God, you know, do on our behalf and then complain or want to go back to where we were. We get so accustomed to what it is that we know that any other option, any other possibility, no matter how exciting, no matter how great, no matter how beneficial for you or for me, is too unknown, too fear-producing to actually check it out. And the Israelites are there. They're grumbling, they're complaining, they're begging to go back to Egypt rather than move across the Middle East and enter the Promised Land. But they keep moving. They keep following Moses and their leaders, and we pick up their journey in the book of Numbers. And Numbers is the fourth book in the Old Testament, Genesis and then Exodus, Leviticus and the Numbers. And I venture to guess that most of us have not done a lot of time in the book of Numbers, because if you're like most people and you want to say, "I want to read the Bible start to finish, right, cover to cover," you start in Genesis. Genesis is an awesome book. I mean, you can make movies off of the stories in Genesis. Get to Exodus, just as good. Kind of bogs down in the middle, but, you know, really good finish. You get to Leviticus. Ugh. I mean, that's where daily Bible reading plans go to die, is the book of Leviticus. I mean, that, right? You laugh because it's true, and it's happened to me as well. I'm like, "Oh, I'm not doing this." And you never get through Leviticus, so because you don't get through Leviticus, you don't actually get to the book of Numbers. And Numbers has some boring stuff in it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's numbers in there. They take censuses, and there's genealogies, and there's laws, and they're like, ugh. But there's also talking donkeys, and there's also, you know, Moses having to, you know, prevent a coup takeover from Miriam and from Aaron. And there's also one of my favorite stories that I want to walk you through here with about our, you know, complaining, whining Israelites. Numbers 13, 1 through 2. The Lord now said to Moses, send out men to explore the land of Canaan, the land I'm giving to the Israelites. Send one leader from each of the 12 ancestral tribes. It's important to recognize that the Lord is not leading the Israelites blindly. He's not saying, you know what, go into this promised land with your eyes closed and just, you know, take them out. He's like, he understands your nature and my nature a little bit. He understands, look, you might need to see something. You might need to test it out or check something out. So send some spies to spy out the promised land and get a feel for it. What do you see? What are the opportunities? What are the challenges of this new promised land? The spies come back in verses 27 through 32 with this. This was their report to Moses. We entered the land you sent us to explore, and it is indeed a bountiful country. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. Here is the kind of fruit that it produces. Now, Scripture doesn't say this, but I'm picturing, like, you know, them holding up some bounty, right? Like, check out the size of these grapes, or look at this, you know, produce, or check out these bananas, or whatever it would have been from that part of the world. This is amazing stuff. But this is a big but. This is one big booty right here, okay? But the people living there are powerful, and their towns are large and fortified. We even saw giants there, the descendants of Anak. The Amalekites live in the Negev, and the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites live in the hill country. The Canaanites live along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea and along the Jordan Valley. But Caleb tried to quiet the people as they stood before Moses. Let's go at once and take this land, he said. We can certainly conquer it. But the other men who had explored the land with him disagreed. We cannot go up against them. They are stronger than we are. So they spread this bad report about the land among the Israelites. Fascinating. The spies come back with a mixed report. The positives, the opportunities are there, right? This is a land flowing with milk and honey. That can be literal. That can be hypothetical. You know, that can be figurative. But either way, it's a good land. This is the type of place you want to go to. This is the type of place where we all want to go to in January. It's that type of place, okay? We want to get away to this type of good land. But it comes with challenges. The people there are huge and scary, and they have scary-sounding names and lineages. Caleb and Joshua tried to convince the people and their fellow spies that it's worth it, that they can conquer this people and take over the promised land. But the other spies disagree, and they do some back-channeling to get the rest of the Israelites to convince them that it's too dangerous, too scary. We pick up the rest of the story in Numbers 14. The whole community began weeping aloud, and they cried all night. Their voices rose in a great chorus of protest against Moses and Aaron. If only we had died in Egypt, or even here in the wilderness, they complained. Their fear is so strong, they prefer to die. They don't want to die in the promised land. They want to die where it was comfortable, where they were slaves, where they knew what life was about. Verse 3, why is the Lord taking us to this country only to have us die in battle? It's only funny because, you know, our wives and our little ones will be carried off as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to return to Egypt? Then they plotted among themselves, let's choose a new leader and go back to Egypt. More complaining, more whining. And that's how powerful fear is. That's how powerful the unknown is. Before the Red Sea, they want to go back. After the Red Sea, they want to go back. They're wandering in the desert, they want to go back. They're at the doorstep of the promised land. They can see it, and they still want to go back to Egypt. And the rest of this particular story is not pretty. The people do rebel. They threaten to stone Caleb and Joshua, who were the minority report spies. God gets upset with the Israelites and threatens to take them all out. He's like, I'm done with all of you. I'm going to start over again and bring somebody else into the promised land. Moses has to intercede for the Israelites. He gets God to not kill or annihilate everyone. But God says this, look, anyone who's alive now except for Joshua, Caleb, and Moses doesn't get to see the promised land. Moses will disqualify himself later in this story. But the consequence is rather steep. Anyone living doesn't get to go in. So 40 years of wandering is what it takes to basically rid this generation and have no one who was alive during the spying event be able to enter in to the promised land. So what does this look like in your life and in mine? I want to walk us through just a few areas where maybe we could see some applications, see some ways where fear and comfort prevent us or keep us from doing what God might be calling us to do. The first area is work, our jobs, what you do Monday through Friday or however you define your work week. And some of you love your work and you're excited about work, and so you can maybe take the next few moments off, okay? But some of us don't. Some of us hate our jobs. We don't like what we do Monday through Friday. Some of us feel like we could do more, like we're working here, but we want to be working there. But we've grown comfortable with it. And we're used to what the job brings us. We're used to the finances the job brings us. We're used to the skills that we are able to do while we're at that job. We rationalize staying there even though it's killing us inside because it's what we know, because it's comfortable, because of the responsibilities that we have. You're like, well, I got a mortgage, and I got kids, and I got retirement, I got responsibilities. You know, I can't just up and do something else. But if the job for you has become brick-making in Egypt, don't you owe it to yourself to at least see what might be on the other side of that Red Sea? Don't you owe it to yourself to at least check out what God might be up to in your life? And I can almost guarantee a scenario for you straight out of Numbers 13, where if you do consider doing something different or at least checking out some other things in your life, you might see some good things. You're going to see some good things. You're going to see some good fruit. You're going to get excited about that possibility. That is going to energize you, but you're also going to come face to face with the giants, with the challenges, with the Amalekites and the Canaanites and the Hittites, except they're not called that. Okay, the Amalekites are maybe called the finances. What if it doesn't pay as much? What if I lose my benefits? What if I foreclose on my house? What if I go bankrupt? Brian, you don't want me to go bankrupt, do you? God doesn't want me to go bankrupt, does he? The Hittites, the relational fears. What will my spouse think? What will my kids think? What will my parents think? What will my friends think? What will my church think? And again, most of us choose to stay put rather than having some uncomfortable conversations, or we choose to keep what people think of us rather than risk something new. If that's you today, I've got a book for you. Same author I mentioned earlier in the service, his name is John Acuff. It's called Do Over, Make Today the First Day of Your New Career. I've got one copy to give away today, one copy for next service. If you're struggling with your job, take this book. Okay, don't take both. I need one for next service. But okay, take this one. You'll like it. It's a quick read, but it's a book I give to people who are kind of, not sure what to do in life. But there's other areas too. It's not just your work. It could be your relationships. Some of you are in relationships, have friendships, have relationships where it's a net negative, where they suck life from you, they take life from you. It's more work then you're getting out of it. And I'm not trying to be selfish with relationships, but there are people in your life who are just, they're takers and they're negative to you. And you need to maybe say, you know what, no more, or draw some boundaries. But again, fear and comfort keep you where you are. Some of us would maybe like to give more, give to church or give to other organizations, but we're afraid because we need that money. We're not sure where that extra money would come from. It's January, so it's resolution time. Some of us have resolutions with our diet, with our exercise, but we're afraid to actually go 100% with them. Even the Holy Land trip that Pastor Greg is taking us on in January of 2019 is an example, right? I know a lot of you want to go, and the reason you're not going to go is because you're afraid. And you have friends and you have family and you have people that say, why would you go over there? It's so dangerous, it's so this, it's so that. Listen, you are more likely to be mugged in Minneapolis than you are in Jerusalem. It's a statistical fact. So unless you're the type of person that never goes to the cities, then you have integrity, okay? But if you're at the Mall of America, don't tell me you can't go to Jerusalem because of the bad things happening over there. It's not true. Finally, with any potential change where fear is involved, consider asking yourself these two questions. First is this. What is the worst that could happen? And second, how likely is that worst case scenario? Now take the Israelites. What was their worst case scenario? Death, right? I mean, they mention it time after time. I don't want to die here, I want to die there. I don't want to die over here, I want to die back in Egypt. Now, we have the benefit of hindsight, but we look at their story, and they didn't die right away. That generation that rebelled, they did die, but they got their 40 years of wandering. But for us, our worst case scenario most often is not death, right? Our worst case scenario is, well, what if I fail? Or what if I do lose everything? Or what if my friends think differently of me? And then I want you to ask yourself that second question, how likely is that worst case scenario? The reason it took me 11 weeks to tell you about a book that I had written for months before was because I was afraid. I thought people might think it stinks. People would go, what a waste of 3 months that was. And I had to come to the point where, you know what? If that's the worst case scenario, fine. I'm not sure how likely that is. There's going to be people who don't like whatever you do, right? So you kind of chalk that up. But I got to the point where I didn't care. I wanted to see what was on the other side rather than have that fear keep me where I was. And so as Jacob and the team lead us in this last song, if you're considering something new, something different, some sort of change in your life, seriously, during the song, ask yourself, what's the worst that could happen if I do this? And how likely is that worst case scenario?